We're doing our class on the Jewish home, and our topic tonight is religion. Okay, so you'll ask if the class is the Jewish home, so what's religion got to do with it? So sometimes religion can be a source of pressure in the home. It can be a tool used to manipulate, and it can be a source of friction between the couple, and it shouldn't be either of the two. So let's begin maybe with a story the Talmud tells us about Hillel. You guys know the story of Hillel. He had an important guest coming, and he came with a guest to the house. You guys know the story? And they're sitting there. His wife was expecting them. And after 5 minutes, 10 minutes that they're sitting in the living room, she isn't bringing the food out. And a half hour passes, and an hour passes, and an hour and a half passes. And finally, after 2 hours, she brings out the food. And they start the meal. And at some point, Hillel turns to his wife and says, "BT," which was their way of saying beloved. Notice that they used terms of love between spouses. That's important. Not only to cover up for forgetting her name, but it's important to use terms like that. Little things build. And he asks her, what happened that took so long today? It took her long enough to actually prepare the whole meal from scratch. And remember, Hillel was the Nasi, so when he has an important guest, it could be someone from the Senate. It's important people. So she says to him, I had all the food ready when you guys walked through the door. And then a poor man came to the back door where I was in the kitchen, and I could see he was really hungry. And he needed to feed his family. And so I took all the food I prepared you, and I gave him. And I started from scratch. I prepared the bread from scratch. I prepared the meat from scratch. I prepared everything from scratch. And he blessed her. And the Talmud brings this story to show us what happens in a home where we breed patience. Where people aren't under pressure. We have a Mishnah, we say, every Friday night, b'me madlikin uvamo en madlikin. What fuels, what wicks can be used to light the lamp for Shabbos? And at the end of that chapter, the Mishnah says, shelosha dvarim yomar adam bebeito erev Shabbat im chashecha. There are three things that a person should say in his home as the night is setting, just before nightfall, before the Shabbos settles in. A person should ask, Isartem, have you tithed? Is the food kosher to be eaten? Have we taken off the tithe? Eravtem, have we prepared the Erev so we could carry things outside the house? Hadlikut aner, let's light the candles in honor of Shabbos. Says the Gemara, even though you're supposed to say these things, and Friday afternoon, we all know what Friday afternoon looks like. So in spite of all the pressure, the Mishnah says you got to say them calmly. When you say these things, it cannot be with pressure.
What are the things again?
Isartem, have you tithed? In our day, we would ask if they remember to take off challah from the bread. Or here in Israel, we could ask again, have you tithed? Yeah, it's relevant again. Eravtem, have we prepared the Erev? In their days, they needed to set up a private Erev to carry outside their house. This could be relevant if you're in a hotel room, if you're on a cruise, if you're somewhere where you don't have a kashrus organization that's taking care of your Erev. Hadliko taner, he reminds them to light the lights in honor of Shabbos. Now, the Talmud says, even though you say it, you gotta say it patiently. You gotta say it calmly. And then the Talmud goes off on a tangent and discusses how a house can look, what a house can look like depending on whether there's religious pressure in the house or not. So the Talmud says, in a house where there's religious pressure, If the wife goes to the store and she doesn't find kosher meat for Shabbos, but she knows that the Shabbos meal better have meat, so then she might cave in under pressure and buy the meat that doesn't have a hechsher. So you read that piece of Gemara and you say to yourself, wait a second, aren't the women supposed to be God-fearing too? And you see the Talmud says even though they're God-fearing, when you apply pressure in the house, you can't know how it'll come out. How often has a woman stood by the candles and she knows on her watch it's really a minute after sunset and not 5 minutes before sunset, but what will she say if her husband comes home and the candles aren't lit? So out of pressure to deliver religiously, she will make the wrong choice. And the Talmud warns us that if you want a religious observant home, then the key is not to have religious pressure. There has to be an understanding, there has to be a mutual goal, but there can't be pressure. Pressure, the Talmud says, backfires. And people very often think that they'll actually achieve what they want if everyone knows, in my house, candles have to be lit for Shabbos. Did we discuss this year the story of the challahs, the guy who had his Rosh Yeshiva over? Oh, this is a great story. There was a guy who finally had the good fortune to invite his Rosh Yeshiva for a Friday night meal. And after davening, they're walking home, and he's basking in the glory of the Shechina. He's so happy. This Rosh Yeshiva's coming to his house for the Friday night meal. This is the moment he's been waiting for. After all, he's learned in Yeshiva. Finally has his own family, his own Shabbos table. He can invite the Rosh Yeshiva. They walk up the steps, and as he approaches the door, he hears World War III going on in his house. So he's wondering what he should do, but he doesn't have much of a choice. He knocks on the door, walks in, and the house is a royal mess. And the kids are all over, and his wife is frantically trying to get control of everything. And they walk in, they sing the Shalom Aleichem, they go to make Kiddush, and he looks down and he sees the challahs aren't covered. And he thinks to himself, oh boy, my Rosh Yeshiva is going to think, I don't even know you're supposed to cover challahs on Shabbos. So he calls his wife and he says, Chavi, you know, we have to cover the challahs for Kiddush. That's na halacha. So she says, yeah, you're right. And she runs to get the challah cover. And they cover the challah and make Kiddush. And the wife is all apologetic. I'm sorry, I forgot. And he tries not to say anything, but he's obviously perturbed. And they finish the meal. And the next morning, Sunday morning, the Rosh Yeshiva calls him in and says, thank you for the wonderful meal. So amazing. Everything was so delicious. He says, by the way, do you know the halacha why we cover the challahs? So the guy thinks for a minute. Why do we cover the challahs? Not to embarrass the challahs. Right? The message was obvious. We take care if we're going to make Kiddush on wine, and technically we always give preference to the bread. So here the halacha wanted us to cover the challahs when we're not giving them deference. So they shouldn't see that, so to speak, we're covering their shame. So it was a message to the guy. He should have thought of the idea and found a way to cover the challahs without embarrassing his wife. Very often we give ourselves license when it comes to religious issues. Parents will allow themselves to shame their kids in shul. People will allow themselves to embarrass other people publicly. And all this in the name of religion. So sometimes it's true. The religion permits it. We discussed an example a week or two ago where a guy is shoplifting and the halacha permits you to catch him, even though technically one of the byproducts of catching him is that he will be embarrassed publicly when he's caught. But, right, the halacha permits you to do that. But when it comes to our home, we have to be very honest and think about Firstly, the importance of things playing themselves out calmly. If we want observant homes, things have to be calm. Secondly, we shouldn't use halacha as a tool to manipulate. Very often in an argument, people like to quote the halachas on their side. If I get a phone call from a wife or a husband asking a halachic question that pertains to the home, I rarely answer. Usually I'll say, why don't we discuss it as a threesome? If there's a halachic question that pertains to the home, very often if one side is presenting it and they're omitting the other side's perspective, they're trying to use the halacha as a tool to get their way. And that's wrong. It's true that the halacha has what to say, but the halacha also takes into account the needs, the desires, the preferences of the different spouses. Sometimes you'll have an issue, which hechsherim do we eat? Which kashrus do we accept in our home? And my recommendation, at least here in Israel, is that you guys should take any Orthodox hechsher. First get used to eating kosher. After a number of years, you could come back and ask the question again. But for starters, a person shouldn't take on stringencies. It's hard enough to eat kosher. But sometimes a husband will have a preference. He wants to be able to say that in his house they only eat this. Or at least that's what he hears other people saying. But if his wife is doing the shopping and they don't sell that hechsher in your supermarket, so then have we factored in the difficulties entailed in taking on that stringency? Sometimes a parent has a very big drive to send a kid to a specific school. And part of it is ego. They want to be able to say, my son's already learning Gemara. And my son already knows half of the Chumash by heart. And if they could sit at the Shabbos table and his kid could rattle off Psukim from the Parsha, he's in seventh heaven. And his wife is against it. Maybe she's right. Or maybe if you're going to present the question, you should come together and present both sides of the question. So there's this weakness that people have where they will sometimes use the halacha as a tool for manipulating, as a tool for getting my way. And most often, people are not cognizant of when they're doing it. People believe they're really doing this in the name of halacha. And that's one of the fallacies that can develop as a person lives alone. Because when it's only me that I have to deal with, then theoretically I'm always aspiring to keep the halacha. And theoretically, I demand of myself. And theoretically, I don't make concessions with myself. So why should I suddenly live a second-rate life? Why should I compromise? But the truth is that we compromise for ourselves. And life is a series of compromises, and that's normal. We have to figure out what works for the house. It's no longer my question, it's our question, it's the house's question. And we have different vantage points. Husband and wife see different sides of the same question. So we moved into an apartment where they did renovations. And they said, being that you guys are going to live there, tell us what you'd like, what kind of countertop. So I thought, gee, black is very nice. All the stains get covered and everything's, you know, you can clean it and not clean it and you're okay. What I didn't think of, thank God someone else thought of it, was that you don't spot ants on a black countertop. Today it's very in to get black countertops. But here in Israel, where it's very common that you have to fight ants, you won't see any on your black countertop. So I guess you'll see them if they crawl around your cottage cheese. But you won't see them when they're crawling into your chocolate cake. So male vantage point, female vantage point. We see different sides of the same coin. And very often if we don't consult or if we try to push our way, then we're really missing the point. One of the challenges in marriage is knowing where to draw the line and not to butt in someone else's business. I'll tell you a story that a girl told me on that date. I don't know who it happened to, if it was her sister or her teacher or someone else. A woman was davening Shmoneh Esrei, and someone knocked on the door. And the woman walked over in the middle of Shemona Esrei and answered the door, spoke to the person, and then went back and continued praying. And her husband blew a lid. You know, what's going on? How could you stop Shemona Esrei and go and answer the door? And after he gave her over the head and told her how shocked he was, she didn't say anything. And only days later did he discover that he misunderstood what happened, that she actually had concluded Shemona Esrei. She took her 3 steps back as she walked to the door, but she finished Shemona Esrei. So the girl asked me, well, what do you think a husband should have done in that stage? You know? So I don't think it's a husband's business to be looking over his wife's shoulder when she's praying. It's her business. What's you know, why do I belong between her and God? It's her mitzvah, between her and God. So people say all kinds of things in the name of all kinds of things, right? But what about the kids? The kids will see all kinds of very interesting claims. At the end of the day, I have my mitzvahs, she has her mitzvahs. If in the big picture we're both striving to serve Hashem correctly, so that's fine. How would you feel if you finished benching and your wife said, what about kavana? You know, we wouldn't feel too great. Now, what happens when you oversleep? One of the things that really bugs me is there's a common email I get where women complain that their husband didn't go to minyan during Sheva Brachos. So I email back, you know, Rav Moshe held that during Sheva Brachos, the only way he could go to minyan is if you come along with him. The halacha says for 7 days, a man isn't supposed to be alone, a woman isn't supposed to be alone. So long as they're together, that's fine. But if he's going to go to minyan and leave you alone at home in bed, that's not proper. So the only way he could go to minyan is if you wake up with him and you go sit in the women's section next to him or something of the like. That sort of changes the tune, right? Sort of Moshe held that that's why we don't make big demands on a chassan to go to minyan. He should try to arrange if maybe someone else could come by and stay in the house while he's away, which usually cannot happen for the first few days after marriage. The morning after the wedding, that usually doesn't happen, and the second day, it usually doesn't happen. And maybe by the fourth or fifth day, you can make that happen. Or by then, maybe you have enough koch to go to shul together. Maybe. But you don't have to be so uptight about one another. You know, people are very tired after a wedding. So very often, the chassan demands of himself. He feels like, how could I start married life and not go to minyan? Fine, I'm all for it. Figure out a solution. Go to a 9 o'clock minyan. You know, do something that works for you and her. What?
I like those.
I didn't hear.
I like
you like those. I'm saying you're in Sheva Brachos. You're a king. It's your Yom Tiv. Just like you could go to a 9:30 minyan on Yom Tiv, so you could go to a 9:30 minyan on your Sheva Brachos. Again, provided that it works for her. But my point is that no one can live in a situation where they feel that someone else is breathing down their back. And that's very difficult within marriage, especially for a chozer b'tshuva, being that very often religion is so central to a person's life. Many of one's changes and decisions and all of life has really come to be defined around this idea of being an Orthodox Jew. So very often it's hard to know where to draw the line because a person sincerely believes that we're both striving for the same thing. So yeah, shouldn't this be a part of what we discuss? So that brings us to the third point of this topic tonight, and that is the importance of having a rabbi, an external rabbi, someone outside the house. Number one, this is good advice for everyone, even a FFB from birth. It's always good to have an external rabbi because, like it or not, we tend to take things personally. So
even if you are like a rabbi?
Sure. I try not to answer any halachic questions in my house. I have a saying that people know me for. I say there's only one person who answers halachic shals in my house, and it ain't me. That's, yeah. It's advice. I told you guys this story, no? I told you this story. So I guess you weren't here then. I told you 2 stories about it. Most of the people here heard it.
Yeah, which one?
Well, I overheard 2 rabbis talking.
Yeah.
Okay, so at any rate, it's a common thing that the Talmud already brings, that there were rabbis whose wives would ask someone else not ask them. And it's recommended. In every home, it's recommended to have an outside authority. One Rav told me his wife came to him one day and said, I'm in the middle of preparing Shabbos, and I'm about to ask you a question, but you better say it's mutter. So he picked up his hand and said, okay, don't ask me, you know. What am I supposed to say? She said, no, you're the rabbi now, so I'm going to ask you, but I'm telling you now. No stringencies here. I'm in the middle of making a cake. You know, okay, what's he supposed to do? She's so the recommended answer is take it out of the house. If you're a rabbi, if you're a chozer b'tshuva, it doesn't matter where you are. You take it out of the house. Have an external rabbi that you both feel comfortable, understands you, understands what it is to be a chozer b'tshuva. That's very important. Don't go to a rabbi just because he's convenient and local. He has to understand your trek, your journey, your wife's journey. So it has to be a rabbi that understands what it means to be a chozer b'tshuva. And if you ask a rabbi point blank, you tell him, look, I'm chozer b'tshuva. We'd like to ask you our questions. Are you familiar with answering chozer b'tshuva? Usually they'll tell you yes or no. Yes?
I'm sort of confused about the attitude of the wife that the husband thought that she was interrupting Shmona Esrei to go and answer the door. That, you know, it's like it's her mitzvah and she'll do what she'll do or something like that. It seems very... like the opposite of the kind of attitude of like Rav Arya Levine, his wife's feet hurt, and he said, my wife's feet are hurting us. So that's in the physical, that's physical pain. And here, the wife, is doing something spiritually detrimental. So what's spiritually detrimental to someone's wife is that not also just part of him. So... feel like he should, as a right to say something like, no, you're bringing us down or me down or something like with the greater I of our relationship, that we're really one or something like that.
Can I tell you? Sorry, I'm sorry, I didn't.
Yeah, basically.
Can I tell you a story of a student who studied here once? Who came to our house like for years on end. And he once asked me a question. And I said, I apologize, I can't give you the correct answer. So we had a very good relationship, like really. So he saw I was serious. He said, why? What do you mean? So I said to him, the correct answer is to smack you across the face. But I don't feel I love you enough to do that, so I apologize. I can't answer you correctly. I'll try to answer you as best I can, but... So he looked at me like surprised. I said, look, there's a balance. You have a relationship with someone if you've invested enough and you've given enough, and the person is so confident in your love, so then... there, that gives you a certain breadth of action. There's a famous story where Rav Kook once smacked someone. Yeah, you always hear about the Rav Kook who was forthcoming and loving. There's also a story about Rav Kook that once smacked someone. So there are certain situations where the correct answer is a smack. But you have to have the backdrop to that scene. You have to really have a relationship where it's so clear to the other party that there was nothing personal about it. It was thought out, and it was out of love. Okay, if you have that relationship, so then... I want to take that over to this realm. In the spiritual world, if you told me that a husband was so confident that he expressed his affection, his appreciation, how much he looks up to his wife, and how many wonderful things he sees about her in the spiritual realm, that if he actually said something about her Shmona Esrei, he would say it gently and lovingly and caringly, and she'd know that it came from a positive place, then in a theoretical sense, yes, that could be what you're saying. But what most often happens, and when I say most often, I mean 99.999% of the time, like maybe once in a yovel, is that the only spiritual feedback that a person ever gets is negative. It's like it's a rarity that couples actually tell one another, you know, you daven with such kavana, it's an inspiration for me. And your benching makes the whole meal worth it. And lines like, you don't even say, you wouldn't even think the other side was sincere if they said it. So then what happens is you don't have that backdrop to the scene. This is a rule in chinuch. Before you can make demands or before you could dare say a word of reprimand or rebuke, there has to be a tremendous amount of appreciation and love that's been given. If you can say that for every one word of negativity, you have at least 50 words of positive that were said, fine, then I'm willing to hear such a thing. Most people can't remember the last time they said something positive in the spiritual realm to their spouse. Think about it, isn't that sad? But I'm saying that's also the fact in education. It's the fact when people raise their kids. How often does a parent tell the kid, thank you so much for peeling the potatoes, it was a huge help. But when the kid does not peel the potatoes, the parent goes off the handle. I wish I could show you an email. I have my inbox right now. Right now. A parent says that their daughter takes care of the whole house all week. Both spouses work late. They get home late at night. And then on Friday, the kid is listening to an MP3 player and she must have her help prepare for Shabbos. And I'm thinking, come on, do you read what you're saying? Like, the kid is dealing with the whole house when you work late every night? Putting the other kids to bed, doing everything? So what if you need her Friday? Tough luck. She's entitled to be a kid, you know. But then I ask myself, did the parent ever stop and thank the kid a million times for all the things the kid is doing right? But the parent, as we all do, notices what's going wrong. And that's the way we all behave. We have to work on it. We have to change it. In the spiritual realm, we're so far behind, we really have to leave that out.
The average person is like, shouldn't say anything. What about their attitude? That they should just kind of like that. She's like, it's between her and God, and I'm going to stay out of it.
So I didn't say that's the only thing. I said you also have an external rub. Meaning there are two points. Number one, in most areas, what's it your business? Now, a guy's going to tell me, but my wife wants to stop covering her hair, and suddenly she decided she's bringing a TV into the house, and she wants to go to the Bahamas and leave me behind. Okay, then, wait, okay, we got a problem. I agree. On any one of those three, right? You don't need all three together. I'm saying if it's something radical, so then you have an issue. Fine, go to someone external. But if it's small things, like the examples I gave, so then I think there's a realm where you have to leave one another space. And before you even think of mentioning something, ask yourself, how much have you facilitated her doing what's right? If you want her to bench without dealing with the kids, do you take control of the kids so she can bench without dealing with the kids? If you want her to daven shachris with kavana, do you take over that amount of work so she can do it? And do you also compliment, do you express appreciation and positive feedback? Again, the ratio has to be 10 to 1. Have you expressed it 10 times? If you've expressed it 10 times, we could think about making one slight, minuscule comment, and believe me, you'll pay for it for a week, at least. And it'll come back like a boomerang. But it might still be worth it. Sometimes it's worth it. The nature of things is that whenever you'll say something, you'll find that your spouse will find a place where they could point out to you that you're the same. And it's not only your spouse. The Talmud says that's the nature of humanity. Talmud says, here, I'll give you a story from my own house. One of the kids, we have a rule by us. If you want to put stuff in the hamper and someone's in the bathroom, so you put the clothing near the door and whoever comes out of the bathroom has to take whatever clothing were at the door and put them in the hamper. Simple rule, right? So we're cleaning up the house and one of the kids says, I don't want to clean the clothing near the bathroom door because I left it there when my sibling was in the bathroom and they didn't take it and put it in the hamper. So their job was to take it because they were in the bathroom. They should have taken it and put it in the hamper. I shouldn't have to take it. So I asked the kid, I said, tell me, when you're in the bathroom and you come out, do you take the clothing that are by the door? That's the theoretical rule in the house, right? But does he do it? So he smiles and he doesn't answer, right? So I said, okay, so go clean up the clothing from the door, right? You can't rebuke someone else for something you yourself don't do. That's a rule the Talmud learns from the pasuk "Itkoshishu vakoshu." The Talmud says, "Kshot atzmecha tchila v'chakach kshot acherim." You have to validate that you're 100% on a point before you dare discuss it with other people. And that's what the Talmud says about the door of the Shoftim. Right? It says in the beginning of the Megillas Rus, "Vehi b'mei shefot ha-shofetim." The Talmud says, what does it mean, shefot ha-shofetim? People would judge the judges. The judge would come and say, "Tol kisam miben shinecha." The judge would come and say, "Take, you have a splinter between your teeth." He'd come and rebuke someone and say, "You know, there's something that you're not so proper about." And the guy would answer the judge and say, "Tol korah miben inecha." You have a beam stuck between your eyes. And he'd tell him, "Hey, what are you talking to me about?" And the Talmud gives an example. Talmud says one of the rabbis, someone sued that his neighbor had a tree that was in public domain and bothering people. And the rabbi said, "Come back to me tomorrow." So they come back the next day, and the rabbi says, "You have to cut down the tree." So the defendant right away says, "Rabbi, on your lawn, there's the exact same tree leaning at the public property." So the rabbi says, "Show me." So they go over to his lawn, and the tree's no longer there. That's why he said, "Come back to me tomorrow." So technically, the rabbi's tree wasn't bothering anyone. It was halachically permissible. But he knew that the second he'd give that ruling, the defendant would say, "Rabbi, look at you." So he said, "I'm not answering your question. Come back tomorrow." He went home, hired people to cut down the tree, even though his tree was legitimate. But now go explain to the defendant that this is different than your tree. My tree doesn't bother anyone. He said, "Fine, if I have to give ruling on this." He had the tree cut down, and then he came in and ruled the next morning. So the Talmud says you can't discuss something unless you're perfect in it. And that's an issue that comes up in the house, that you're going to try saying something gentle. Wait and see. She'll show you where you're not perfect in it either. And it's true. That's why you'll find it. The Talmud says that's human nature. So the first things we discussed were, A, religion succeeds in a home when it's without pressure. B, we have to know to give one another space. C, we're not looking over someone else's shoulder. And if there is something, we can go to an external rav and be prepared that if you say something, it'll come back to haunt you.
If you say anything.
I'm just saying, in this realm. I want to end with two more points. They're a little bit contradictory, but that's okay. Number one is chumrot, when it comes to stringencies. So very often people have all kinds of mishigasim. Every person has their thing. So we have to be careful. Very often we make a big deal out of something that's not a big deal. And you have to know to discern, and that's one of the reasons that it's helpful before you make a comment to go and ask a rav, because sometimes the rav might actually tell you either that you're wrong or that it's not so important, that you're making an issue of something that's a non-issue, like the story of the Sheva Brachos and Gong to Minyan. That's point number one. We have to be careful with regards to chumrot. Remember, it's a chumrah, so it's not always worth fighting over. Most often it's not. And that's where it's good to consult with an external rabbi. And the final point is to respect the woman's chumrot in the kitchen. Very often, especially if you've learned something, so then you see certain things happening in the kitchen, and your wife goes, "Nah, don't do that!" Right, and you say, "Hey, take it easy. It was cold. It's not the end of the world." You get all kinds of answers. There's a reason why women are so careful, and their chumrot in the kitchen makes sense, even though it doesn't say it in the Shulchan Aruch. But it's correct that they have separate towels for meat and milk and parv, and it's correct that they don't put down a cold pot of meat on the milk on the dairy counter. And it's correct that they don't wipe down the meat pot with the milk sponge, etc. And when us men mess up, so our first thought is, halachically, it's not so terrible, don't worry. No, respect what she says and get used to doing it her way, because her way will ensure the kitchen remains kosher. And our way, even though technically you can say this is okay and that's okay, by the end of the year, you'll have mixed up many pots and pans and etc. Now, this is something I've said for many years, and after almost a decade of having this series, I've wisened up, and I'm going to add one more point. Okay? Here's an important point that comes from years of experience. Just this Friday, I got this phone call. Okay, so here's the story, a Shaila that came in Friday. And I'm quoting a Shaila just because I did the same thing a month ago. But it's a recurring theme in a Jewish home. So a person calls up. It's an hour before Shabbos. True story. Person calls up and says, we're having a house full of guests for Shabbos. And I just discovered I cooked the chicken in a milchik pot. Now what? So the answer to the Shaila is less relevant. But how did it happen? So I'll tell you how it happened, the same way it happened to me. Because women know their pots. They know this handles meat, and that handles milchik, and that handles parv. They know their pots. And when you first get married, you'll do like all good Jews do. You'll label your pots. And you'll know this lid has a blue sign on it, it's milk. And this pot has blue things on the handle, it's milk, and you won't use it for chicken. But after a decade of marriage, the signs start wearing off. And when you reach almost a decade and a half, so your signs, your handles are off. You know, the handles you put the signs on are off. You're already handling these pots with gloves, but they're good pots. You don't want to get rid of them. You're handling the pots, right? I beat you to that one, yeah. So then the women have no problem, but us men suddenly find ourselves cooking a chicken in a pot with the fleishik lid, but the milchik pot. And then you suddenly realize, wait, I made a mistake. What do I do now? So this is the addendum. Make sure to keep your pots labeled in a way that you men also recognize what's milchik and fleishik. The women are fine in the kitchen, but when you find yourself at my stage of the game where you're suddenly saying, wait, what kind of handles did this used to have? Right? So then you got to get spray paint or nail polish and put on the different sides of the pot and the lid markers that will remain. This is milchik, this is fleishik, this is parv. That's just a practical adjunct.
Yeah. Like a few years ago, we had to do all of our pots again because this was like becoming like a daily thing because we didn't
know what it was anymore. Yeah. So I'm saying it happens over years that the signs you made wore off. So I used to have the blue tape and red tape and yellow tape in the kitchen. I thought that was enough. But then the handles come off or the lids start falling apart.
Did they really come off?
Yeah. Come visit. Yes.